Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. In this podcast, we tackle the tough, often unspoken realities of motherhood, neurodiversity, and mental health. Hello and welcome to ADHD Mums. Today we have another episode in the mini-series. This is going to be the final episode to the school mini-series. And of course, we're going to finish it up with Millie Carr. How are you, Millie?
I'm really good, thanks. How are you, Jane?
I'm going good. I'm very excited about this episode because here at ADHD Mums, we don't want to continue talking about the problem. I think you've absolutely given practical skills in every episode. That's always been the focus. But in terms of moving forward, one thing I have never really seen or heard anyone talk about is what we can actually do moving forward. I think we all know that. Teachers, principals, the government seems to know that. But no one seems to know how can we start, what would make it better. Because I think if we could actually figure out what it is that we were asking for, we could put a dollar figure on it, and then we could somehow get to a point where we're like, well, this is actually a solution. Are you going to say yes or no, government? Because you know what? Something that really, really grinds me. Like, well, who created the NDIS? That was Bill Shorten, and I don't know what they were thinking when they created that. It seems very obvious to me that they've made some massive errors and they're trying to clamber back. And I'm like, let's not leave these people to make any decisions about what should change in the education system, because I'm a little bit worried about that. So what I think it'd be great today is to talk about what are we asking for? What would it be like if it changed? So to kick that off, I think one of the best questions to start with is, what's the core difference between inclusion and assimilation in schools?
I feel like inclusion is something that gets thrown around at the moment. It's a bit of a buzzword. Everyone's talking about inclusion. But inclusion isn't just inviting people into the existing environment, expecting them to just sit there in amongst the existing environment. It's changing that environment so that everyone belongs and actually feels like they can do their best learning and their best work and everything in that space. And at the moment, inclusion is kind of, we keep sprouting inclusion, and schools will say that they're inclusive in nature, and then you'll have a student that is in the classroom that is potentially just being left there in the corner. They're included because they're in the classroom and they're part of the class list, but they're not really included in the daily activities. Their needs are not completely being met, and that's where we're having a lot of the other issues that we've talked about in previous episodes, because the inclusion isn't inclusion. It's actually kind of, let's just let people be in the same space, which is not inclusion. That's the assimilation. That's where we're just like getting people to come in, and we're not changing the environment for people. So if we're wanting true inclusion, we actually really need to think about the environment and what is the environment like, and is the environment something that's set up to benefit everybody, or is it an environment that's set up that only benefits a few people or some people, and then there are people that are in that environment but they're not actually really belonging or succeeding or doing their best learning or work. And that's kind of the difference I make between those two things. And I think the inclusive word is being spoken about a lot. It's being said everywhere. Everyone's got inclusive practice and we've got inclusive schools and inclusive classrooms. But what does it actually look like? And it doesn't look like what people are talking about. It's not just having people there. It doesn't make it inclusive.
Yeah, it's a great point. Like, technically, we've invited everybody. Yeah. If I have a wedding, I've technically invited my family, but I know that some people can't afford it. I'm going to have it in Bali. So I'm inadvertently inviting only the people that have got the money to afford it, which I've separated out from everybody else, but they're invited. It's not my fault they can't afford it.
Yeah, definitely, Jane. Schools can't say no to having people enrolled in their school. They technically can't reject people from being in the actual space. However, it's only inclusive for the people that it actually works for. So it's inclusive if that environment actually works for you. Well, then that is inclusive for you, but it's not inclusive if it doesn't actually work for the majority of people. And if you're in an environment that actually isn't catered or built to actually suit you, then it's not really inclusion. And that's kind of, I think, the big difference that we're talking about.
So then when we talk about special education units, sometimes there's talk that they are not always the most progressive option, even though they're framed as a great option for some parents. What do you think needs to happen there?
I'm talking and responding to this as a parent of a child that goes to a specialist school. So my son goes to a specialist school and has done so since he was in prep. He is currently in year 9. And the reason I made that decision, I am not really someone that agrees with having everyone separate. However, the environment, like we were talking about just before, actually isn't suited for him. My daughter came to my school, and that's a different kettle because it wasn't actually suited for her either, but she came to my school to look like she was more suited. My son just was not going to be catered for from the absolute get-go. He would have been sitting there. He would have just been sitting there doing nothing. And that's, I've seen this happen before. But going to a specialist environment, you've got more staff, more education support, potentially more resources and funding. The class sizes are way smaller, but it's not always still the best environment. So my son's been to two different specialist schools. And one, I feel like, again, he was doing a very similar thing that he would have done in mainstream school. There was more visuals and things around, but it still wasn't actually completely inclusive for him. And also by separating these students out into a different environment, the students that are at a mainstream school are not seeing disability. They don't see what it looks like for students that are struggling with different areas that need different accommodations. And they're not able to actually understand why students need that and then not be able to create an inclusive environment when they're older, when they move out of school. And that's why we have people that struggle in workplace environments and out in society, because we haven't grown up with everyone together and seeing those different differences as well. So that's an option. And like I said, I'm saying this as a parent that has taken that option. And the only reason I've taken that option is I feel like I have no other choice. There is no other choice but to take that option, because I'm either putting my son in a mainstream setting where he would be completely adversely affected, or he's in a specialist setting where he's catered a little bit more, but is completely excluded from other children that are not similar to him as well. So there's that really big exclusion of him from the mainstream environment and from society. And we kind of push people away. And last year there was the recommendations that came out about disability inclusion and what it would take to actually make a more inclusive society. And one of the recommendations was that we get rid of exclusions and specialist school settings. It's to actually by 2030 combine everyone together. That worries me at the moment though, because we don't have the environment to do that. I love the idea of it, but it's actually not going to work at the moment. So there's a lot that actually needs to be done to get to that point, because I wouldn't feel comfortable right now having my son attend a mainstream classroom setting that I actually teach in, because it just would not cater to his needs absolutely at all at the moment. So it's a really, really tricky kind of thing. It's a good option, and I'm glad that it's there because the environment isn't catering to those students at the moment. But is it the best option, and is it what we want to aim for, is to have them excluded? I don't think so.
I'm going to have to bring it back to the NDIS and do the whole ADHD thing where I bring it back to my own situation. So I was just thinking, this is very similar to the NDIS. And so the NDIS, I reckon, is similar in a way at the moment, because they are moving a lot of the autistic kids out. That I don't even think we can argue that's not happening. That is actually happening in real life right now. And so that's okay if the NDIS is going to move towards with more complex needs. They're saying they're trying to divvy up 1, 2, and 3 autism. I don't really agree with that, but let's just say that they're doing that. Okay. Well, my argument there is that if that's what you're going to do, that's okay, because that's the decision made by the government. But we cannot do that until we have the community support set up. So the NDIS and the government is saying, if you are moved out of the NDIS, if you are not renewed, you don't meet the requirements now because we've changed things, that's okay. Go to community supports because they're there for you. But they've done it the wrong way. They haven't set up the community supports yet. So there's this massive gap. Mm-hmm. A part of me is like, maybe you've got to have the gap to have everybody fall down into the middle of it to get them to do something. Because at the moment, getting them to set that up is just not happening. But everyone stuck in the middle right now is just left completely stuffed. And I was actually interesting that you brought that up with the special schools, because when they first brought that out in Queensland, I actually thought that was going to be great. However, I'm going to state I do not have a child in a special school, so I don't know enough about it to comment. But from somebody that uses the mainstream system with IEPs and all of the whole thing in the mainstream system, I was like, we need to see change. So maybe this would force change. We absolutely cannot cater for any needs at all at the moment, let alone kids that have been at a specialist school coming in. So that would have to force change. But with the NDIS and what's happened there, I'm like, hang on a second. I assumed that they were going to do something. But now I'm looking at it like nobody's doing anything about those poor kids that are left absolutely nowhere. The single mums, they can't afford anything, that are just being completely left after having maybe a pretty decent plan,
So is the government actually going to shut the special schools, bring in these children with this poor teacher that's already got 30 kids that she can't even cater to anybody, and then she's going to bring in 5 or 6 special students as well?
Yeah.
I thought they were going to do something about it first. I'm really worried.
It's a very worrying thing, and that's the reason why the decision that I've made personally is to actually put him in a specialist school setting, because I just don't think it would. Working at a mainstream school, I have seen students like my son in the mainstream school setting not being catered to now. I've seen it. Teachers, they are out of their depth to deal with, even just like we were talking about masking needs and smaller, lower support needs than having someone that is completely non-speaking, someone who's using AAC, someone who needs assistance with toileting. I said, I love the idea of it because it allows students to actually see disability as not something that's just, you don't look at it, you don't talk about it. It's just something pushed away, which is what's happened. We're going to push these students away at the moment. I want to see that, but it's just not going to cater to that. And there are already students in the system at the moment that are struggling with this. There are students that I've seen them sit there in the corner. Everyone else is doing their work and there are students just sitting there in the corner. We're just babysitting them. Do you know what I mean? It's essentially babysitting, and that's not okay. They deserve an education. They deserve to be treated and their needs and their goals be met. And that's not happening. And I just don't know. Like I said, the recommendation from the inquiry was 2030 to have completely inclusive classrooms where we kind of blend specialist settings and mainstream settings together. That to me is only 5 years away. And I actually cannot see how that's going to happen at the moment, unless we really, like, there needs to be massive change. And that's something that I guess people like yourself and I, we're kind of talking about it, but it's just really tricky.
Yeah, it is tricky. I had Tanya Waring on in an episode a couple of weeks ago in the school mini series, and she has a son who's very externalizing in his behavior. He's been to both special schools and mainstream schools, and she did talk about what you just spoke about with the babysitting that she said went on. Like, he's technically at a mainstream school, but he's in a library by himself reading a book, and he doesn't get the opportunity to participate in a group and feel that sense of community because he's always separated. But he's technically there, I suppose you could say, but how does that feel for him, and does that hit his goals that he needs to for himself? Anyway, so do you think, Millie, because we are actually at 2025, and that is not very far away, and we are calling out for massive change with kids that can go to mainstream school. We are seeing the least attendance in public schools nationally that we've ever seen. We are seeing homeschooling become, like, it's almost mainstream now. You know, as compared to when we were young, homeschooling was seen as very odd and different and not accepted. Anyway, reason what I'm saying is we're in this position. We are 5 years away. Do you think that we will amalgamate into one? Do you think that we are just going to wait until a few months before and then some politician's going to go, oh yeah, I suppose we should just probably put them in together? Like, how is this going to work?
I don't personally think they're going to act on the recommendation, because it is a recommendation. I don't think that it's going to be acted upon in the time frame that was suggested, which is 2030, because I think politicians recognise there's a lot of work to be done. It's a big job to do it. The person who actually steps up, and actually this is not just a small, tiny little thing. This is a very big system overhaul. And I think there are people that are starting to recognise that. And I don't think the recommendation will actually be acted upon at this moment. I don't think it's going to happen by 2030. It could be different and things change in 5 years. But at the moment, I can't see that happening. And I wouldn't want it to happen until the environment changes either, because I just don't think it would be, it's already hard at the moment for teachers, for students and parents. And then if you were to do that, it just would, it's a massive, massive thing. So I don't think actually it will happen at the moment, Jane. I'm hopeful that it happens one day, but there needs to be a lot of other stuff happening and politicians realizing how we can change the mainstream environment first to then be able to then make those environments more inviting and more inclusive for people to start working into that environment from a specialist setting.
Okay. So if we look at the education models, because I always see people that are moving into, let's say, the Sunshine Coast on Facebook, and they're like, I'm moving from the UK and my child used to get this when they were in the UK. And where can I get that here? And, you know, there's like a lot of negativity on those comments. And the poor woman who's moving in is, wow, because it's almost moved back, because you're not going to get anything like that here. What education models do you think actually work, and why do we not see more of them here?
the education models that really, really are coming out research-based and evidence-based that are actually being really beneficial for students are trauma-informed, strength-based practices. Things that are looking at co-regulation, preventative practices, entire school culture of language that is more inclusive, thinking about play, thinking about students' interests, thinking about moving away from standardized testings and things like that. They're the kind of environments that we're understanding now that are actually very beneficial for students. The problem is, in order to move to those, it's quite expensive to go from what we've got currently at the moment to move into that. And a lot of schools are bound by policy, government, and what their expectations are of the education system. And a lot of education systems in different schools rely on data and their results from these standardized tests to actually say whether they're doing a good job or not, when we know that's actually not a true indication of what's actually really going on the ground. There are some really fabulous practices that are around, but different states have access to different things as well. And we spoke about, I think a couple of episodes ago, when we spoke, Jane, about, you know, it depends on what postcode you're in is what kind of environment you're going to have for your child. I can speak for Victoria myself, because I am in Victoria, and different states are different. I have looked into the different states. Victoria have got a mental health menu, which has got different programs that are research-based that you can access publicly on the Department of Education website, that have different programs that you can access via school, and you can access it and use your funding to pay for the programs. One really great program that I absolutely love, and if anyone's listening has heard this before, the Berry Street education model is absolutely fabulous. It's trauma-informed and strength-based. They work on making sure we're building in brain breaks, thinking about our emotions and relationships, co-regulation, all of that fabulous stuff. It's very, very, very expensive. This is not a cheap program. This is a very research-backed program, and it's been research-backed by lots of research done at Melbourne Uni, but it's just very expensive. So in Victoria, teachers can pay through their funding to actually get their staff to actually do the training, whereas in a lot of other states, you maybe wouldn't have the funding to be able to pay for it. It can cost thousands to get your staff trained in this, and then you have to have someone continuing the process of rolling it out and making sure it's going really well. So the funding and the expense of all of it is the biggest barrier, I think. A lot of schools are recognizing that these kind of practices are better, but it's just very expensive to put them in place, and to actually completely change and get teachers trained in these programs is very expensive.
And so where does that program, like where have you seen it before?
It's an Australian-based program. Yep. It is Australian. It literally was founded by a professor from Melbourne Uni. It's been going, there are schools open in Victoria called the Berry Street School. So the actually school is where they've trialed it out to start off with. I can send you all this information, Jane, if you want, if people are interested in looking into that school and their practices, because you can access it as a parent yourself as well. You can access training and stuff through their website. They also have a book called Trauma-Informed Practices. It's really fabulous and really easy to digest. Even a school could buy that book for their staff and have that as be the start of the PD. But the actual PD from them, like I said, is quite expensive, but there is a lot of research backing. They've done lots of analyses and studies across multiple years to show that it actually is a really beneficial program. And it's one that I really enjoy and kind of use in my daily practice as well. So I can give you some information about that program, because it can be accessed Australia-wide. It just can be varying price point for different states, because some states, no other state apart from Victoria, have a mental health menu where schools can pick research-backed programs to actually put into their school. There are programs every state use that are different and that the government recommend, but nothing that has like a choice, whereas Victoria, you've got like a menu that they can choose multiple different programs. It's quite a good resource. I can send that through to you too as well, Jane.
Okay, so why can some schools operate a program like that? Is it a very expensive private school? How does it happen that one can be like that and one's not?
It's how the school chooses to use their funding. So the funding that you receive through the government, every state operates separately in their education department. And so different schools, even in Victoria, that have access to this program and can use their funding to supplement this program to make it cheaper, they get to choose what they want. So it's not like they're mandated to choose particular programs. Public schools are choosing to use it. It's just that it's how you choose to use your funding and what your leadership team in your school want to actually run PDs for. So there's a lot of things that teachers and schools are focusing on, and it's where their focus is. A lot of teachers, you know, schools are focusing on maths or literacy and don't always prioritize something that I think is a really, really important area, like getting this kind of training for the whole staff, which is recommended for the whole school to have this training, not just the teachers, the admin team and everything get this training. It's a 4-day training program. So that's the problem, I guess, with these kind of different education models. They sometimes are hard to access, which is why it's tricky. And you've got different schools that have zero awareness of trauma-informed practice, and you've got some schools that are doing really, really great things.
So then do you think more schools would move over to a different model like that? Like, to be honest, I didn't even know there was different models. I just thought, I don't even know how this is going to work.
Yeah. This is the reason why I'm coming on podcast with you, with like yours, Jane. We are trained in these things. We can see this stuff is working, and this is the things we want to change with the government. I think I spoke about it a couple of episodes ago. The policies are there. They've got policies for inclusive practice. That they're going to have inclusive. They say in their policies, they're going to have trauma-informed inclusive practices, but the schools have no idea what trauma-informed practice is. If you go and ask your child's school, they may not even know what that even looks like, and they have no idea. And then you blend that with even knowing that, which is going to trauma-informed practice and strength-based practice helps students with the neurodiversity-affirming practice as well. You need to have another element of that too, though, that we're seeing at school where we're training teachers to understand the different diagnoses, the different things that might happen in the classroom, how to respond, and how there are some simple universal design for learning. So that's called UDL. I'm going to send you these things, Jane, so that all of your listeners can look into it. So UDL, which is universal design for learning, is another thing that is starting to become bigger in different areas, a lot in the UK, which is why maybe the parent that you were talking about before has seen that. There's a UK website I'll link to you. Universal design for learning is about creating the environment to cater to the majority of people. It's about making it universally having support so you're not having to just put adjustments in for 5 different kids, because that becomes extra work for you. As a teacher, that is a lot of work if you have everything set to one environment and you're making this adjustment. But if you just make that adjustment across the whole classroom from the get-go, things like visuals, I'm talking about some like things that can be universally done, broken down instructions. They help students with ADHD, autism. We know the research shows us that our executive functioning needs that. Why does only 5 kids need to have that? Let's do it for everybody. It's going to help everybody. It's not going to hinder anybody at all. So these kind of things like UDL, trauma-informed practice, if the teachers knew this stuff, if the teachers were trained in this from the actual get-go, when they were at uni, we're going to set the environments up and we're going to mitigate a lot of what's going on in school. It's going to just be a big kind of change.
Oh, I agree. And I think we also take away the parenting fact that is at play as well in terms of privilege. You're going to have people mm-hmm. that are from different backgrounds that may not have access to a diagnosis, that have access to a hospital, they're regional, or they've got access to the public system and a pediatrician has failed them there. Well, that's not okay, but at least the school would support them with where they're at. It's not as important because so many people fight this fight, thousands of dollars, years and years to get this letter to give to the school, and it gets them nowhere. And it is heartbreaking. I've been in that situation too, where that's happened. But what you're talking about would mean that unless you're going to access ADHD medication, which is a different thing, you don't necessarily need to have that diagnosis. You could have trauma, divorce, a pet died, whatever it is, but you've catered to everybody where they're at, no matter what diagnosis they have. I think that would be amazing.
Yeah. Yeah, if we just come in with a trauma-informed lens for everybody, we come in with a strength-based lens for everybody, and we come in with a neurodiversity-affirming lens for everybody, it's going to catch the people that we're talking about, the students that are masking that we don't know. People are asking, how do I tell? If they're sitting there in the class being fabulous the whole time, like, what are they supposed to do as a teacher? Put these things in place from the get-go, and then this will help them. From the start, they're not going to be sitting there thinking, oh my God, I have no idea what's going on, because they're going to have a broken down list of instructions that everyone's got to help them. They're going to have a scaffolded example so that they can look to it and not just sit there and go, I have no idea what to do. They're going to have built-in breaks for their brain. I think every teacher needs to learn about how the brain works. We know that the brain, when it switches off and it flips its lid and our frontal cortex goes off, we can't talk to kids like that. But teacher, I've seen it happen because, again, they don't know. Teachers are trying to talk them off a ledge and it's just making them explode bigger, 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 bigger. Sometimes they're things that, like, once you learn, you go, oh my God, that makes so much sense. But a lot of the teachers don't know that, and we don't focus on building the teacher's capacity is the number one thing we can do to actually change the education system. If we put more money and more focus into actually building the teacher's knowledge and awareness, having more allied health in schools, having more psychologists, OTs and speech. We don't learn what they learn at uni. There's a reason. I can't be expected to be an OT and a speech at the same time as learning how to teach. They need to come in and give me some help and advice. We need more people in the environment doing that. We need so many little things, more education support, so there's more bodies in the space, lower classes, like all of this is the things that need to happen. But at a bigger level, it needs to be done from the top and be forced down, because at the moment, schools are allowed to make a choice on what they choose to include in their school and what programs that they employ. And I think we need to be making sure we're prioritizing programs that are not going to cause trauma, that are going to mitigate trauma. So school-wide positive behavior or positive behavior is a big thing that it's across Australia wide that is used as one of the major programs for behavior. And what you would see in a classroom with that is there's usually a chart and your child's name gets moved from different sections of whether they've made a good choice, whether they made a bad choice. And that's an Australia-wide practice. And I have a really big problem with it because it's not neurodiversity affirming, because you can have a student that gets put on the green little sticker thing for doing great because they sat there, crossed their legs and they looked and focused at the teacher. And then you've got a student who can't do that because of their disability, but they'll never get the little green sticker for doing that. So all of those kind of practices, that's an Australia-wide thing that needs to kind of, you know, we need to stop picking those kind of programs and start including trauma-informed and strength-based programs that are neurodiversity affirming, and we're catering for that from the get-go. And they're the ones that I look out for. And there's a couple of examples that I've just given you today of ones that are like that.
Oh, I think that's great. Look, I've got a couple of teacher friends, as we all do, and they were saying to me that when they do their teacher training, they often have someone come in and they may explain the science and the developing brain and how it works. And she's, we've heard that so many times. But what I want to know is practically, what do I do? In theory, I have 30 kids. I have two that are doing this. I have 28 that are over here. And I have my principal on my ass because I've got to get this done. What do I do then? Because she said, I can tell you all the science, like they can't hear because they're upset. And I get all that. But what do I do in scenarios, practical examples? She goes, I don't think I've ever had that explained to me. And I was like, oh my God. And she said to me, the only training that we get is the same shit.
Mm-hmm. It's the training from universities. I did a 4-year bachelor degree and it was granted about 17, 20 years ago. It did not teach me what I needed to teach in the classroom. I learned a lot of that on the job. And I did a bit of a survey about a month ago on a teacher Facebook page. So it's filled with all teachers around Australia. And I asked the question, did you feel that you were able to cater to neurodivergent students in the classroom based off your training from uni? And there were 900, and it kept growing, 900 teachers that said that it did not feel they were able to cater to neurodivergent students in the classroom. A lot of them commented and said, we did one subject where we kind of brushed over it. You might have learned about the brain, like you said, Jane, like they've learned about the actual science, but they actually haven't learned what to do when that happens and how to go about that. And then you've got the only people that are doing extra training know what to do, or people with lived experience. So if you've got lived experience with your own children, then you're able to come at it in a different kind of light, which is a lot of what I've had, lived experience through multiple years of living through it myself with my kids and then doing some extra training. If you haven't got that, then you're in the class just blind. And we need to focus on making sure the teachers are prepared and don't feel like that in the class. They shouldn't come into the teaching profession and feel like they're not prepared to actually do the job, which is what is actually happening at the moment. And it's 4 years of money and time that they're putting into something to get to the job and then be like, well, I actually don't know what to do here. And they're floundering and people are leaving the profession because it's so hard. Because if you don't know what you're doing, well, of course you're going to find it hard. How are you supposed to operate when you don't know all of the things? It's like we're gatekeeping information. We can make them learn how to regulate themselves. A lot of teachers don't realize how to actually manage their own emotions in the classroom, which kind of escalates situations even bigger. So there's so much work that needs to be done, I think, around teacher training and around building our teachers up to be able to be the change. They're the ones at the ground. They're going to do this change. They're the ones that are doing the teaching. So we need to get to the teachers and we need to teach them all of this great stuff that is like readily available, just people don't know about it or haven't been taught it.
But teaching would not be the only industry that I've heard very similar things about. Like, for example, we utilize a lot of allied health, which a lot of listeners will, OT, dietitians, exercise physiologists, psychologists, and a lot of them will say the same thing to me. They will say, we only did one unit on the NDIS and that's an OT. Like, well, what did you do for the other 4 years? So when selecting an allied health person, I know that a degree means nothing. I'm like, this person has to have kids. They have to have 5 years on the job, because you cannot rely on graduates having really any knowledge in the area that they've just studied.
Yeah, so it's ridiculous.
I completely agree with you, but I also think that goes across a lot of different industries, to be honest. Because, like, when do we ever update our training?
Yeah, exactly right. And then it's up to the school to actually continue, because we do constant professional development. Every school needs to have professional development and learning around neurodiversity affirming practice. Every school needs to know that. You need to, as a teacher, be aware, because you are coming into contact with students with diagnoses, whether they're diagnosed or not. You need to know about what to do and how practical solutions and strategies actually make the classroom safe and make it really inviting and belonging. Because if you don't know that, you could be inadvertently, not deliberately, but doing things that are causing the trauma and the burnout that we've been talking about the last few episodes.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, so when we think about moving forward, as we wrap up this episode, what can we do though as parents in terms of actually creating change? What can I do today to make any kind of pressure to get something changing here? Do you think there's anything?
Look, I'm really hopeful that if we speak our stories, the collective is bigger than just one voice. And we started the petition, Jane, where we've got people, we want to go to MPs, we want to write letters to MPs, we want to band together with stories, with evidence of the fact that it's not working. We can't let them just continue on. Unless we make a giant big sound about it, things just continue on without anything happening. We need to speak up. We need to write letters, speak on podcasts like this, share your stories with other mums. Go into the school and ask for what your child is legally deserving. These are things that we have to move to doing. And it's unfortunate that parents of neurodivergent students, it's kind of the burden is kind of falling on us to kind of make a noise. But if we don't make a noise, they don't know that it's this bad. Teachers need to do it as well, though. This is an across the board system wide issue. Teachers and parents need to band together to make noise. We're not separate. It's not teachers versus parents. That's not the reason we're having issues, is coming from higher, not from either side. We need help. We need actual support to be able to cater to the students in my classroom. I need smaller numbers. I need more allied health. We need this stuff, and we need policy in place at an Australian level to make sure that state governments are doing it. Because, Jane, every state is different, and some states are very poorly doing this. Some states, bare minimum, don't even have access to some of the things that we do in Victoria. So I know there's different states I've gone through, and I could barely even find their inclusive policy. I couldn't find anything about how to practical strategies for teachers. I couldn't find anything. If you go to the Victorian website, you can actually find things and strategies and actual things that teachers can actually use. Unfortunately, they don't go looking for it, but it is there. Whereas some states have nothing, absolutely nothing. So from higher up, we need to make a noise so the Australian government can actually mandate some things so that your state is actually doing what it needs to be doing for education and to make it inclusive and make it just a nice environment to be in. Because it's so hard for both teachers, parents and students at the moment that teachers don't want to be in their profession. We're losing really good teachers because they can't keep bearing the brunt of a lot of this. A lot of teachers that are informed about this or that are doing extra work, they get lumped with a lot of the students that other teachers have trouble with, and that's not sustainable for them either. They can't have five or six students in their class when the other teacher who doesn't know anything and can't handle that has only got one. That's just not fair. The amount of IEPs that teacher is writing, there are people that are really good leaving the profession because of that, because they can't hold the load any longer. And then parents, as we know, parents and students are just crying out for more and they're struggling.
I think that's been such a great episode. So what we need to do is, the change petition is in the bottom of the show notes, which it is in every episode of the mini series that I've launched. So the change petition is there. We can also band together. One thing that I think is a good idea, actually putting in a complaint, I think helps too, because let's just put in some complaints. Do I expect it will do anything to help my child today or tomorrow in the next few months? Probably not. But can we at least log all of the complaints? And I think if you're in a position where you have a child that may be expelled, what I think Tanya Waring says very well, because she's been on those behaviour management plans many times with her particular child, she says, let them expel them. Do it. Because she does not want to leave a school. She wants to be expelled because she wants it to come up on the numbers on how many children are being expelled. Because a lot of the schools don't want to own up to the amount of kids that they are expelling. So they'll put pressure and then the parent will remove their child first. It can feel a little bit nicer as a parent, I would imagine, to be the one going, look, we're not going to come here anymore anyway. It's like when you see a breakup happening and you're like, I'm just going to break up with you because I can see it coming. Mm-hmm. However, Tanya Waring believes to let them expel your child to add to the stats of the numbers of the kids that are being expelled by the mainstream system. If we just keep putting the complaints in and forcing them to expel rather than us leave, maybe that would influence the statistics a little bit.
I love that idea, Jane, because the government bodies do look at statistics. Do you mean? They're very concerned at the moment about the absenteeism rate, which is astronomically high and has grown so much in recent years. So they're concerned about that, but they do like data. So I feel like whatever we can do to get data and the size of the problem needs to look big for them to do something, I'm worried about. That's the problem. We've got the education minister that you can write to, Jason Clare, but there's also a new minister that just come in out of the new federal election. There's now a disability minister as well. So together, there's two kind of ministers that they've got their foot in the door around this issue and need to be on top of it. And then you've got your state departments as well that you can contact as well, because they're the ones that can actually change your state's actual kind of system. I'm thinking Australia, though, needs to kind of act and realise that so much is happening in different states. And if you look into it, it's actually quite sad. So, yeah, we need to say something, do something, make a complaint, write forward, sign the petition, keep speaking about it like we're speaking about it. And we can't just sit silent because something needs to happen. We can't just keep complaining about it because we're complaining about it. But there are solutions. There are actually things that we can do. There are things that we can actually do. We just need help from the government. If money is the issue, like you said at the start, Jane, let's put a price on it and say, this is what we need to do to actually flip it around. This is what we need. And they need to actually start listening.
You know what? This is a really weird metaphor, but I know that your neurodivergence will get my neurodivergence.
I love metaphors.
I was trying to imagine, right, if I'm the government or if you're just a person buying a piece of clothing for a child. Now, I know, and we all know that Kmart and those cheaper type shops, right, they're very tempting to go to because it's not so much cheaper to get it. What I do know is that after purchasing something from Kmart, which I do feel dirty about doing with the child labor, what I also notice is that we all know that it doesn't last long. It's almost like throwing money at a wall because it felt like it fitted at the time. It suited you right then in that moment. But 3 wears later, you've got an old threadbare piece of t-shirt that's all crinkled up and it's all short and small. And you're thinking, I basically threw $10 at the wall, supported child labor, and then put that in the bin and then like ruined the environment. Great job, Jane, for today. But if you were the government, you might think to yourself, the mainstream system is like a Kmart t-shirt at this point, I think. Mm-hmm. But if we actually went somewhere sustainable with a better background, better culture, and we were putting our money together towards something better, we would then have a piece of clothing that we could then give to another sibling, give to a friend, give it to Lifeline, recycle this thing, and we haven't supported child labor. But it does take, in that moment, a little bit more time to go to a different shop and a little bit more money to upgrade the t-shirt. Yeah. And so this is where I'm like, well, if you're going to spend the money on the Kmart t-shirt, government, why don't you just spend another 10 and get something that's sustainable that's actually going to work? Because we're creating so much damage. Could we not put more money in and at least get something good?
I love that metaphor, Jane. I love it. And we keep doing the same thing because it's going to be hard. This isn't like a quick, easy fix. We can't just change it overnight. And there are people that are stuck in their ways, have been in the system for 30 years. It's going to take time. If the time isn't put into it, we just continue on the way we've been continuing on. The teachers will be gone. More students are going to be being homeschooled or having problems with wanting to go to school, experiencing trauma when they leave school. School shouldn't be that. It should be fun. Learning, neurodivergent people especially love learning. Like we love learning. We love to find out about our favorite interests and learn and do new things. But we can't do that. The system that it is at the moment doesn't cater to everybody. There's a portion that is excluded and it's not okay. And we need to make it cater to everybody.
And you know what else? It isn't free. the taxpayers, us, we pay for that system. And so when someone was talking to me recently about having private school and going to a private school and then you're paying for it, so, you know, they have to, you're the more the client and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, back up a second. We all pay for public schools. The taxpayers pay millions and millions and millions of dollars. We go into a system that is shit. So it's not this, we don't pay, we all pay. So why do we not have a better system? So I'm getting a bit ranty, but I'm like, I don't understand how they can get away with doing this to our children whilst we all just stand by, but it's not free, we pay.
Yeah, exactly right. It's not. We're all paying for something that is not working. People are saying it though. We're all saying it's not working. It's not working. They're just not listening at the moment. It's not a big enough outcry potentially, or it's a too hard basket situation. And I think that's kind of the problem as well. We just kind of, everyone jumps from here. Let's go do this best thing. Let's go do this best thing. We need to just slow down. What is the best stuff? And let's actually rehaul it to actually do this from the get-go. Not everyone doing all different kind of silly stuff. And it shouldn't matter where you live for what kind of school you get to.
I agree. But I also think some of these politicians, same with the new Minister for Disability or the Education Minister, what they need to do, I believe, is to get with the people. Like the Education Minister, where are their kids? Are they in a public school in Western Sydney? Or are they in an elite private school somewhere with all the bells and whistles being catered for? Because are they actually there, and would they drop their child off at that school? That's what I think should happen. Because it's like, where's the investment here? I don't see it. In disability, I don't see the investment. I want to see somebody in there who's got lived experience with disability in their family. And I want to see an education minister put their kids in some of the schools that we think need help, but they don't experience them because they're out in their elite school out the back. Of course we're invested. We're the people. Who are you? I don't believe that they're that invested. I don't. And I think a lot of these politicians have not even worked in the private sector. They've just gone into politics at 18. Like, what experience do they have of actual people? Are they actually passionate about any of these areas? Or do they buy time, say key phrases, just to get in and then have a rest? Because that's how it seems. I haven't seen anything happen at all for a really long time, even in the lead up to the election.
Yeah, they say the right things.
Exactly.
But actually, in terms of education, in the lead up, there wasn't much talk about education
anyway. There was nothing.
There was not much. In my opinion, I didn't think it was good enough because I was like, well, even from any of the major or minor parties, we're actually really talking about the crisis that is education. The minister talked about, you know, they're going to lower TAFE rates, but that's not the crisis. We need it. What's happening in our actual schools and what's happening with the parents is it's just exhausting. And yeah, I don't think they actually are fully aware. We know the damage that it's doing because we're living it. We're in the middle of it. Like, we're in amongst it. They're not in amongst it. And they're a little bit out of touch with what's going on in the actual system at the moment.
I completely agree. I went out to the major political parties and the smaller ones in the lead up to the election. And I went in on the disability front. This is what I think needs to happen with the NDIS. And it was not, oh, just open checkbook. I think it does need to be some changes. Yes, I think you could save some money, but how about you get some lived experience people to talk about that with you? I understand if it has to make some changes. However, who is making them? And this is what I believe it needs to happen. Same with the education. I did too. Not one party wrote back to me. And I have no real political allegiance. I was more like, who is going to give me some airtime? And if you want to be the only party to have written back and actually addressed this and even acknowledged it, great. I'll air that. Where are you? Not one wrote back. And that was in the lead up to the federal election. And I was like, wow, I was expecting to get a letter of some crappy little fluffy thing that would just say, we got your letter. Didn't even get that. And I was like, well, what hope do we have after the election if nobody's willing to even address it in the lead?
Yeah, we're going into another big problem again. This is like a separate problem again, politics and politicians and policy. Who's in charge of actually doing what's going? Do people in charge of sorting out the education system, are they aware of even the curriculum? We need some actual people that are in the ground in part of these kind of areas, some like working parties that have parent voices, student voices, teacher, leadership, all different people coming together to work together on this. And I'm not sure that they're kind of getting all of the voices before making their policy. I can't obviously say for sure, though. I don't know what they're actually doing. All I know is whatever's happening, is not working and they need to change it because something needs to change because we are at breaking point at the moment. I think it's a breaking point now. It's happening. Like we're in the middle of it. It's not happening in years. We are at the point where it is at breaking point. Teaching numbers, teachers are the lowest numbers ever in teaching. Teachers are leaving their profession in droves after a couple of years. We're losing good people. Students are not going to school. The homeschool situation is higher than it's ever been. It's just broken. It's broken at the moment. It's only going to keep getting worse unless we actually do something. And look, the more voices we have, maybe they will listen. So the more sign our petition, the more that we have stories. How can you listen to a story about our children and what's happening to our children in the schools? And I can't see how they can't care. I mean, maybe they don't, but I'm hoping that the more we have those really like emotional stuff, this is what's going on. This is like stories. We're not just making this stuff up. Maybe it's not happening at your school, but other schools, like I know from my own experience, my school, I don't see as many of this, but still do. But then I keep hearing, sometimes I hear some stories, people email me about things and I'm just like, I can't even actually fathom that it's actually happening, that people are treating people this way, parents, students, teachers. It's just all not okay. So I don't know. The more we go, I'm really hopeful, Jane, that I've always been someone that wants to see the good in people.
I think that neurodivergent people who are quite genuine and they have good intentions, it doesn't occur to them in the moment that the other person does not. So they're going in kind, good intentions. It doesn't occur to them that anyone else is going in any different. And I think that's what you're referring to.
That you're referring to me. That is what I am like all the time. And I always am just like baffled by any response that isn't respectful, kind and nice. And I just go in there going, surely people want to do the right thing. Surely people don't want people to be struggling and to be leaving and to be upset. But that's not the case, I don't think. The more I interact with different people, the more I go, oh, it's not, yeah. I can only talk to the people that actually kind of will listen, I guess. And the more we talk about it, that's all we can keep doing is talk about it, write letters, complain, put complaints forward and advocate for our child. And hopefully the more we do it, the more voices and hopefully someone's going to take some notice.
I think you've made a great point. One of the reasons that I'm so passionate about the NDIS is because I have a jot form running and all I get in my inbox all the time is just horrific story after horrific story with the NDIS's treatment of children. Mm-hmm. What I think I need to do after this recording is to create the same thing for in the jot form for schools.
Yeah.
We need to put them in the show notes and then we need to get these stories coming in because what you're talking about is right. And one of the reasons I did it for the NDIS is because people were blind to what was actually happening. Mm-hmm. And I was reading the DMs, reading the emails, and then someone would email me and go, you're creating fear. That's not really happening. And I was like, so I created the jot form. Now I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of parents and I would never break confidence, but it's about data and creating a spreadsheet to then give to the NDIS minister. So what we need to do, the same thing, is create data. What do you think about that?
I love that, Jane. I think the more we can collect, the more evidence, because it's happening. I know it's happening.
Totally. Let's just say in 2 years' time, if the education system is the same, hopefully it's not, we would then have 2 years' worth of data, let's say. And if they've finally said, okay, here's a seat at the table, who would like to do it? I don't think you and I would be picked. But we can at least submit the jot forms of all of the experiences that could be taken into account. Because I just want them to see real life, the real public system across Australia in all areas. And I don't think that is represented.
No, I agree. I think they're ignorant or don't want to know how bad it is because some of the stories are just terrible, absolutely terrible.
Completely.
And if we can collect them, I would love to collect as many as possible, Jane. Like people need to just write in and let us know what's actually happening and how you're feeling because that's the stuff that people care about.
Let's finish that up there. That was a cracking end to the mini series on schools. Thank you so much for your time, Millie. You have done so many episodes. I really want to, one, thank you so much, and two, point everybody in Millie's direction. I've got her website and her Instagram on the show notes. She's got some amazing books on her website. She's also got a cracking Instagram account. I'd love you to get in touch with Millie. I'd love you to sign the change petition and fill out the jot form. Thank you so much for your time, Millie. I really, really appreciated it.
I always enjoy talking to you, Jane. Thank you so much for having me on.
Quick announcement. Did you know that we have an ADHD mum's shop filled with resources designed just for you? These resources are packed with answers to the most frequently asked questions I get sent in via email. Everything from understanding ADHD and autism to practical tips for daily life. There's also a free assessment tool. If you're wondering about ADHD or autism for yourself or your little one, don't forget to check out the free assessment tool under free resources section on my website, adhdmums.com.au.